I think we've all been in this situation where we try to hit the button and we need to tap it 5 times till it works. And for us, it may be just inconvenient, but for someone that has an impairment that affects their fine motor skills, for example, it may just make it completely unusable and therefore not accessible.
Welcome to Nerd Out at Spotify, where we bring you behind the curtain of the world's most popular audio streaming subscription service. Machine learning, open source, clouds, tabs versus spaces. We'll talk to Spotify engineers about interesting tech issues, big and small. I'm Dave Zolotowski, principal engineer at Spotify. When we get caught up designing a cool new feature or a faster, better way to do something, it's easier to forget the fundamentals, like whether someone can even use the feature in the first place. You might spend hours tweaking the algorithm that shuffles songs in a playlist, but what if your user can't even tell whether shuffle is on or off because they can't see the color of the button? Today, I'm talking with an engineer on Spotify's accessibility team, Danny Devesa Dirksenstotz. We'll hear how he went from a 5-year computer science program where accessibility wasn't even mentioned once to becoming so passionate about the topic that he wrote a book on it. We'll get into the basic things we forget to consider when we don't consider accessibility, how we can all benefit from accessibility improvements, whether that's getting up a curb in a wheelchair or while pushing a stroller, and ways to address accessibility issues in your development process, from adopting a multimodal approach to UX design to integrating accessibility tests into your CI/CD. Throughout, we try to answer the bigger question. How do you get developers and designers to adopt an accessibility mindset and make it a fundamental part of the development process? So here's Danny, joining us from London, where he's based. Hey, Danny, great to have you on. Can you just tell us a little about who you are and what you do at Spotify?
Yeah, I'm an iOS engineer in the accessibility team at Spotify. I've been at the company for a bit more than 3 years. When I joined Spotify, I didn't know what project I was going to be starting to work on. And when I joined, I found out that it was the Spotify Kids app, and it was a super fun project to be involved with.
I see. Yeah, that sounds really cool. So then how did you make your way over to accessibility?
So when I joined Spotify, I was really passionate about accessibility. I was actually about to publish a book about it. So one of the first things I did when I joined was to find if there were any accessibility initiatives in the company. And there was actually an accessibility guild. So it was like a group of people that were very passionate about the topic as well, and that would meet every now and then to discuss what they've been working on or what things we could do to make Spotify more accessible. And it was great to see that I was already in a company with so many people that knew what accessibility was and why it was so important.
How'd you first get started with accessibility as an area you wanted to work in? Was it always something that you were excited about?
I'm a bit embarrassed to say that I kind of stumbled upon accessibility. I think I finished my computer science degree around 2010, and it was mainly software engineering. And I don't remember hearing the concept of accessibility in the whole computer science degree, and it was a 5-year degree. And it wasn't a very good student, so I may have missed it, but I'm pretty sure it was not part of the curriculum. And the first time I heard about accessibility was actually a couple of years after. I started working for a startup. It was a social network, and it was a tiny team. So I was doing both iOS and Android apps. And because I wanted to just to make my life easy, I used what is called native components for both platforms. So native components are the components that either Apple or Google give to you out of the box, like buttons, text fields, images, and all the sort of things. Some more complex components like navigation bars, tab bars as well. So one day we get an App Store review of a user saying, "Thank you, co-founders of this social network, for making the apps accessible." And I thought, what? I haven't done anything really. So I did some research, and then I figured out that if you use native components, especially in the iOS side, they already have a very good level of accessibility. And still then, I thought accessibility was equal using native components. I didn't know that you could really customize the app a lot and still make it accessible. And it wasn't until I started working for the BBC, that was in 2016 more or less, where I really understood and learned more about accessibility, because the BBC, being a public organization, they really care about accessibility and about making their products usable by everyone. And they have a very strong culture on accessibility. So if I'm correct, they had the first accessibility champions network, similar to the accessibility guild we had at Spotify, in any tech company in the world.
So then tell me a little bit about your team. I mean, you mentioned there's an accessibility guild. I mean, are you a permanent part of an accessibility team that isn't just the guild, or are you on a team that works on something else now that isn't the kids app and accessibility is this kind of guild-based side thing?
Yeah, we are a team of five that work permanently on accessibility, and the accessibility guild is something that right now doesn't exist, but what we are working on bringing back, because we think a big part of it is about creating community and about getting people passionate about it involved and help you with the advocacy side of it. We have though like an accessibility Slack channel that I invite everyone to join always, and where we have really interesting conversations. And what's interesting as well is like, despite not having like an official guild, you see more and more people jumping in and answering questions without us having to be involved. The goal of the accessibility team is to put ourselves off the job. So ideally, people know enough about accessibility that we don't need to get involved. In practice, I don't think that's something that can happen, because you can also innovate in the space of accessibility, and there's always more you can do. But yeah, I think creating a community is super important. And what happens in a lot of companies is maybe you have the one person that is passionate about accessibility and that drives the whole thing, but it's not really a viable strategy, especially if you don't get other people to work with you.
Yep. So it's almost like you have the Slack channel, and that the activity in that Slack channel becomes kind of a gauge of how well the company's culture and processes have adapted to taking accessibility into account. That's cool. So I definitely want to get into a bunch of those things later. I took a few notes here and there, but first I want to back up a little bit and just talk a little about what is accessibility. I think we've used the word probably a couple dozen times, but haven't really explained what we even mean. So let's start there.
That's a good question. There's a couple competing companies that have very good definitions of accessibility. One is Apple, and they say making technology usable by everyone. And the other one is Microsoft, and they say the qualities that makes an experience open to all. So I like both, and it looks like how even like two companies with very different approaches for things can even come together to something like accessibility. It is about removing the barriers in between your product and your users. The idea is for everyone to be able to enjoy it and to use it regardless of their abilities. And that means thinking about people with disabilities. For example, one thing we tend to think about is that developing software is that users are like us and use the products we build as we would use them.
Yep.
For example, we tend to look at the screen and read to consume the information. We tend to touch and tap and swipe to interact with it. But there's users that will consume the information using sound or a braille display. Or there's users that will interact with their devices with the keyboard, their voice, or as little as a single button. So I think that's something super important to take into account when we are developing, especially apps. And most of the things I'm talking about as well are about assistive technology. The assistive technology is any technology that acts as an interface between the user and your software. So yep. One example, a screen reader. And a screen reader is a software that allows a user to, especially blind users, but not just, to use software. So for example, in mobile apps, you can tap in the screen and the device will speak out loud what you just selected. And it would say, for example, if it's a button, so you know that you can interact with it. Or it would say if it's a heading, for example. And then it provides with gestures as well. Like you can swipe left to go to the previous element, swipe right to go to the next one, and double tap to interact with the button. But a lot of times people think accessibility is equals assistive technologies, and that's not the whole thing. I think also accessibility has a massive overlap with user experience in general. And just a small example is thinking about buttons and touch targets having an appropriate size. I think we've all been in this situation where trying to use an app in the phone, we try to hit the button and we need to tap it 5 times till it works. And for us, it may be just inconvenient, but for someone that has an impairment that affects their fine motor skills, for example, it may just make it completely unusable and therefore not accessible.
Yep. I was going to mention that part too, that like there's a lot of accessibility things like features in the operating system, and then there's a bunch of these kind of design conversations. And I was curious if you had some good examples of that. I think the size of touch areas and things is certainly a good one. I don't know if there are things that you found surprising. Like when you started digging into this, there were non-obvious accessibility use cases. It wasn't like screen readers, but something you had never thought of before, or non-obvious design elements. It wasn't just bigger buttons, but some really interesting other thing that just blew you away and you got excited about.
Yeah, that's something, a concept that is super simple, but I think it's super important. We call it multimodality. And that's basically the idea of presenting important information with multiple modes. And by modes, we mean color, shapes, messaging, sound, haptic feedback. It needs to be a combination of those so everyone can perceive that important information, right? So a great example, I think, at Spotify is the shuffle button. You may have noticed that it has a dot underneath the shuffle icon when it's on, and it's not there when it's off. So initially, it was just white when it was off and green when it was on, but that made it so some colorblind users would find really difficult to differentiate between both states. So we got that feedback, and we added just that little dot underneath. So now it's, I would argue, easier for everyone to differentiate between both states. Another thing, in the Spotify Kids app, for example, you need to introduce a parental pin to be able to change some of the settings of the app. So initially we thought, okay, like if the pin is wrong, we can do a little animation that shakes the whole box, letting the user know that it was the wrong one, right? But it happens that users can disable animations and can ask to reduce motion because they may feel like motion sickness or get distracted by animations. And so if you do that, suddenly the user has no idea that the pin was wrong. Or if you use a screen reader, the animation means nothing to you as well. So we made sure that that worked with the reduced motion setting, and we also made sure that there was proper messaging together with the animation. And the more modes, like the better, like it's going to be just easier for the user to interpret.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, even just picking on one of those examples, I guess you started with the shuffle button. I understand how you get the complaint and how you understand the colorblind problem. How did you settle on something as simple as just adding a little dot underneath it as being a solution? And how did you even really know that it's working?
We have a good connection with customer support, and anything that comes to them that is accessibility related, they come to us, and we are constantly monitoring what users want for us to improve in terms of accessibility. Our main job as well is to interact with and to collaborate with other teams to make that happen. So we may have an initial meeting with that team and explore different solutions. And the most important bit is to know that it works. So in my case, for example, I'm not a voiceover user. I'm not a keyboard user. So most of these things, I may have a good guess of what a good fix might be, but we always need to test with the real users, in this case with users with disabilities. And in the disability community, there's something that they say about, and it's nothing about us without us, and it makes sense. I think a good comparison is when you train some data based on a lack of diversity of data points or people working around it. If you work on solutions without people with disabilities contributing to it, it's impossible to make it so it works for them. So it's super important in our case to test it with end users.
And that also brings me to a different thought of, there's all sorts of different, I'm not even sure what the right way to phrase this is, but like different kind of types of accessibility, or in my head, I made it up as saying like the app is being inaccessible. I don't know what the word for like not having accessibility is even, but there's users with disabilities or users that may be in a temporary state where they can't interact with something, or I don't know, maybe there's like social constraints that aren't necessarily a physical disability. Like, is there a collection of these different types? Actually, the other thing I thought of in talking to you was the kids app, right? Kids interact with things very differently. So it's not disability. It's you're a child. You're not used to, I don't know, a keyboard or something. Mm-hmm. Do you have some sort of a collection of personas that you target, or some way you narrow this really broad range into something you can actually solve as an engineering problem?
Well, yeah, I think inaccessibility or inaccessible is the right word. So something can actually be completely inaccessible. With the Spotify Kids, I think it's a great example as well, because some kids like don't know how to read, right? So for us, it was super important that they could pick up the song they wanted without knowing how to read. And that's actually an interesting problem, because in an album, the cover art is the same for all the tracks in that album. I like that you mentioned as well something that is super important. A lot of times we tend to think about disabilities as this permanent thing and something that one in the very far side of the spectrum. So for example, we tend to think about absolutely blind users, and there's so many different types of blindness. There's the people with vision loss, or there's colorblind people. And more importantly, is to know that some disability can be permanent, and you can have also temporary disabilities. So in the case, for example, you may not have one arm and that's permanent. You can have a temporary one where you broke your arm and for a few weeks you won't be able to use it. And you can have a situational disability as well. In my case, I have a 1-year-old. I spend a lot of time holding him in my arms. So a lot of times I may not be able to use either one or two arms, and I cannot use my phone as I would normally use in that situation. So in a situation of disability in that moment. And I may rely more on my voice, for example, or on voice assistants like Siri. Something that I like a lot, for example, in the Apple Watch, and not many people know about it, is you have a feature called Assistive Touch. So you can just interact with your watch without touching the screen, but with like clenches and pinches. And that's super interesting, because also it brings me to this idea that if people knew more about assistive technologies, they would see themselves using them more and more often, because they're absolutely useful for everyone in lots of situations.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I think the first thing I was really amused about when you started was I said kids may not be able to use a keyboard, and you said the kids can't read. And I think that's like the much more obvious thing. My kids are older than yours, so I don't think about them not being able to read anymore. But of course, like, your phone doesn't even have a keyboard. So it's a pretty bad example on my part. And this very obvious can't read thing, of course, stood out to me. But I think the thing you said about these temporary disabilities is super interesting. Does that at all impact the way you engineer these features? Or is it really like the feature that you build for someone that like had some permanent reason why they don't have an arm really isn't different from the feature you would build for someone like you that might be holding this child for a short amount of time, but is used to using both hands with your phone and probably most of the day does use both hands with your phone?
Yeah, I think we tend to focus on the permanent one. And as you said, I think it's something that very likely made the life easier for people with temporary and situational disabilities. An example that is used a lot in the accessibility world is the curb cuts in the sidewalks. Those ramps, so you can cross the road without having to go through a step. And it's called the curb cut effect, because I think it was a group of disabled activists in Berkeley, in California, in the 60s, 70s, that started really demanding for these curb cuts because they were wheelchair users and they couldn't move around. And when you think about it now, like, it's pretty much impossible to think that you don't have one of those curb cuts to cross the road. It's so useful for everyone, really. I have a baby, so moving the pusher around, I wouldn't be able to do it without those curb cuts. So they were thought for wheelchair users in the first place, but you can see how that benefits everyone. Like someone delivering something that is very heavy, or a cyclist, or maybe old people that have a walker, for example.
Yeah, exactly like you said. I've never even thought of the sidewalk not having it. So I guess maybe on that same note, from a, like a tech application point of view, are there standards here, or are there like organizations that exist to create rules like every X amount of meters you must have a curb cut, but the tech version of that?
Yeah, there is, and it's called WCAG. So that's Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. And despite of having the web board at the beginning, it applies also to native apps. It's just that they were developed when apps were not a thing. And they have three levels of compliance. That's AAA and AAA. AAA being like the gold standard and minimum requirements. They're based on some guidelines that they call PUR, P-O-U-R, and that's perceivable, operational, understandable, and robust. To be able to perceive stuff, to be able to operate with it, to be able to understand it. And robust means about solutions that are valid across platforms and that are valid in time and across different assistive technologies.
And is any of this enforced? Are there requirements like, I don't know, in the iOS App Store, maybe must be at the first level, or if you have some amount of users, you must be at some other level. But like, I don't know, are there any like forcing functions to make people build apps that adhere to these levels?
Unfortunately, not in at the App Store level or Google Play level, but the legislation is actually catching up faster with the fact that a lot of software is not accessible. And most of the laws that are starting to ask software to be accessible are relying on these guidelines. Usually what they require is to have level A as a bare minimum for it to be considered accessible, which is sometimes a shame, because the fact that an app is level A means that they pass and they have a basic level of accessibility, but it doesn't mean it's accessible or it has a good experience or is usable. And there's some laws that are already enforcing that to be something that needs to happen in public applications, for example, built by the government or public organizations. And I think in Europe, in a couple of years, they're going to start enforcing apps to be accessible, for example, for things like transport or banking. And what they're using as just guidelines to understand something as accessible is those WCAG guidelines.
And so I guess, can you talk a little bit about maybe like the history and evolution of this space, similarly to how you talked about curb cuts as a thing that happened and now has become a standard thing? I don't know, how long have any of these things existed, whether it's the tooling in these platforms or the WCAG or these regulations?
I'm a mobile developer and especially an iOS developer. So the interesting thing I usually tell is that when the first iPhone was presented, it was not accessible. And that's something really strange to think these days because Apple is considered such a leader in the accessibility space. 2 years later, when the iPhone 3GS, I think it was presented, is the first time that they mentioned accessibility and they added a few accessibility features in iOS, including VoiceOver. And that's when I started becoming aware of accessibility. And the great thing is that Apple has been adding new features year by year. And a few things that they've done since then is to enable switch control support. Switch control is typically for users that don't have much mobility. So it can be as little as a single button. And in that case, you have a cursor that scans the screen and you can tap that button to select it. You could have two, one to move forward and one to select. There's many configurations you can have. They added support to control iOS with your voice. That's a very cool one. I'm not talking about Siri, but you can actually speak to your phone and say, like, tap the close button or go to home or scroll down. And it's pretty magical how it works. And one that I really like is called Dynamic Type, and that's the ability to change the configuration in your device so you can increase the text size. You can decrease it as well if you want to have like more information on it. So yeah, it's in constant evolution, and that's something that is really cool as well, that you may think at some point, okay, I think it's a pretty mature field now, right now, but no, it's still evolving a lot.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So the text size thing brings back a lot of scary memories of internationalization, where in different languages, words have completely different lengths, and it's hard to make a button that can fit a word of any length and make it look good in all the sizes. But if you have dynamic sizing, then you know by definition all these things are going to change size.
Yeah, and especially if you've been long enough in developing iOS apps, back in the day, there was just one screen size, and that was 320 by 480. And that was true for many years. I remember even hard coding the numbers around, you know, like this is position to 480 minus whatever. And yeah, soon enough, we started learning that we need to make apps adaptive. And that's a good point that you brought, because when apps work well for different text sizes, they tend to work well or better for languages like mine, like Spanish, that tend to take more space to say the same thing in English than in Spanish.
I guess to go back a little bit, we talked a little bit about the history of some of these things outside of Spotify. Can you tell me a little bit about accessibility at Spotify? I mean, were the first versions of Spotify kind of similar to those early iPhones, or were we like magically perfect from the start?
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm not completely sure, but I would imagine that yes, if you've seen like screenshots of the first versions of the iOS app, it looked like very, like it didn't have much of the Spotify branding, but it was very iOS-y. So I would assume that even if the developers working on the app didn't know much about accessibility, it was probably fairly accessible. And as the company grew and we started doing more custom stuff and custom components and to make the app feel much more like a Spotify app, is when you actually need to put much more focus on making those things accessible. Because when I joined, I could see that for a long time, there's been people that knew about accessibility and care about it at the company. And there was this example of the shuffle button as well, right? Something as specific as adding a dot to a button to make it more accessible. So I think we are lucky that at Spotify, it seems we've always had people that were aware of it, which is like the main problem we have in the industry. A lot of people like myself, just a few years ago, don't know much about accessibility. And it's great to be in a company that's not the case. And people know about it. And more importantly, know that it's important.
Do you feel like this has been growing lately? Like there's been more and more of this, whether it's kind of at Spotify or in the industry, or some places are great about it, some places aren't, and we'll see.
There's still a lot of work to do. When you do some testing, some random testing on the apps I have installed in the phone, you still find lots of apps that have very basic accessibility issues that are super easy to fix. Yeah, I think the industry is starting to realize that it's very, very important. It's interesting because a few years ago, I think when I started, we had this conversation usually on automated testing. And a lot of the reasons why companies didn't do it back then are similar to the things that we say about accessibility these days. You know, like it takes a lot of time and there's not clear if there's a clear benefit in the future or it's difficult to test stuff, you need to do some refactoring. And to me, it's a bit incredible that we got to a point where automated testing is so embedded in the culture of engineering these days, and it's something that you see in every job listing, in every interview, but we haven't managed to do with the same with accessibility, especially when automated testing is making sure that something works, and accessibility, as we said, is about making the thing work in the first place.
Yeah. So I guess since you touched that, tell me a little bit about that piece. Like, how do you test accessibility? We talked before with the shuffle button about how you can test with the real users and see how they interact and talk to customer support and stuff. But that seems like a extremely slow feedback loop. Are there quick and easy or automated or some kind of ways, like a, I don't know, on your local machine and CI/CD kind of ways to know that you did accessibility right?
Yeah, there's several layers of testing accessibility. Automated testing is something that I would like to see improved in the next few years. When you think about it, like, the first layer is some sort of linting rules, but because that's like the quickest feedback loop, right? As you develop, you can highlight some issues. The problem with that is sometimes difficult to implement and very limited on what they can catch. So for example, in iOS, there's one rule that would flag if an image is lacking an accessibility label, which is called alt text or alternative text for images. And in the case of missing it, it's because maybe you wanted for it to be decorative. So if an image is just not giving you important information, you flag it as not accessible. It's just a way of removing noise for, in this case, voiceover users or screen reader users. So linting is the first layer. Then you have some apps that help you scan for accessibility issues. In the case of iOS or Xcode, you have what is called Accessibility Inspector, and you can run an audit in your simulator, and it will flag up things like color contrast issues or buttons that are not big enough or text that doesn't support dynamic type or the ability to configure larger text sizes, but it's quite limited. And the problem with those tools, with scanning tools, is that it's a voluntary thing of the developer to go and actively open the inspector and run the audit. So you need to convince them that it's adding value to their flow. But as you mentioned, the most interesting thing is to have these checks on the CI, and you can actually have accessibility checks that run together with your UI tests, for example. And those checks are going to be similar to the things you can run in those scanning tools. But again, they're fairly limited on what they can catch. I think they're still good because it avoids having regressions, for example, or missing very basic issues. It also acts as a reminder to developers that if you miss something that is quite basic, you probably didn't put enough thought on making the thing accessible in the first place. So hopefully the engineer will go back and not just make it pass, but have a proper think on how to make it more accessible.
So how do you begin to get thousands of designers and engineers to think more about accessibility in everything they do? Can you talk a little bit about getting all the engineers of Spotify, all the people building features, to care about this stuff and to use the tools that you've built?
Yeah, that's a great one, because when I joined the team, my first reaction was to try to fix all the things myself, test things and find what's wrong and see if I could fix it. And then I realized, like, it's not a sustainable way, especially at the scale of Spotify. We have not just one massive app, but many apps as well. And what I found as well is I was spending 80% probably of the time trying to understand the feature and then making sure that I wouldn't break anything. And then 20% maybe of the time actually fixing the feature. So that didn't seem very efficient. Better way was to really collaborate with teams and to get them on board and to work with them, because they could show me how to fix it. And then I could show them like how a lot of times accessibility issues are fixed with literally a one line or a two lines of code. That's also a thing that has worked really well when you go to a team and you show them, okay, like this issue I fixed, say like this is the PR, it's been 3 lines of code. And yeah, can you help me with the other issues? So yeah, I quickly realized that my role wasn't that much of hands-on and being like fixing things myself, but more about getting people on board and everyone to work alongside with the accessibility team to own the accessibility of the features.
I gotcha. And how well do you feel that's worked?
Definitely much better than my first approach. I'm lucky as well that at Spotify, as soon as you go to the team and you show them the issues you found, they're more than happy to work with you on fixing them. It's a slow process, but I feel like the culture is improving and it's kind of a snowball effect. Sometimes you go to a PR and you do some comments about some accessibility improvements. The next time that person is going to come back to ask you questions, the next time you actually see that person giving feedback in another PR, and I love when that happens.
That sounds like a lot of what you just talked about is things that exist and things we have, but maybe a few of the things you said need to be part of every developer's everyday process. A few of these things are things we can do better in CI. Kind of, what else is a team like yours doing to improve accessibility across Spotify?
Yeah, one of the things that I think is super important is to work closely with design, because every feature or most of the features need to be designed. So by doing that, you make sure that accessibility starts early in the process. And like anything, it makes things much easier and cheaper than if you try to do it further down in the process. And a lot of the things we do are about advocacy and education. So I like this thing of being mindful of the time you take drawing versus the time you take sharpening your pencil, right? If you are all the time sharpening your pencil, you'll never draw. But if you don't sharpen your pencil properly, drawing is going to be very difficult. So to me, the educational aspect of our role is sharpening our pencils. And it's like making sure that enough people have the basic tools and the basic knowledge about accessibility in the company. Then we do a lot of support. So teams that know about our team would contact us saying like, hey, we're looking into developing this feature, or we are about to release a feature. That's not ideal, but it's better than contacting us after the feature is released and just to ask, is it accessible or what can we do to make it better? And yeah, so those are the things that we do the most these days.
Yep, that makes sense. So tell me a little bit more about the education part. And is this like part of Spotify onboarding? Is these like courses you take optionally? How do we educate everyone? I mean, I guess you didn't even mention necessarily that there are courses. Are there even courses, or is this more of just like a general education documentation sort of thing?
Yeah, there's a bit of everything that you mentioned. We write documentation as well. We have some video tutorials that we record, but mainly we have an accessibility session for our onboarding process. So we make sure that every designer that starts at Spotify has a basic knowledge of accessibility and especially knows that our team exists and that we are there to support them. We also have some courses for engineers as well, and they can voluntarily take in their own time and pace, or we also organize courses that are a mix of in-person plus self-guided. So we have a small exercise to do for them so they can test what they learned and again, ask more questions about it. And it's good because people learn in different ways. Some people prefer to do it themselves, and some people need maybe a bit more of a help and questions and an interactive way of or being involved with other people to learn those concepts.
And then you mentioned kind of there's places to innovate in accessibility. Interesting of what you see as there are interesting next steps, or if there are things you see elsewhere in the world, like really interesting new technology that you think can drastically change accessibility for the better.
Yeah, I think an example from the past that I think is really cool. So a few years ago, for example, Yahoo Finance tried to work on how to make charts accessible for blind users. Because up till then, when you'd find a chart in an app, for example, with a screen reader, it would probably say the title of the chart and maybe to announce a couple of interesting features like the maximum, minimum, or average, or trend. But if you think about it, like the user was missing so much information, right? And there was no way of navigating a chart like a session would do visually, right? So they thought about this cool thing where you can select the graph and move your finger around it, and it would play a sound with a different pitch depending on the value in the y-axis. Yeah. That's super cool because you can actually follow the trend of the data, right?
Yeah.
You get so much more information about it. And to me, it was such a cool idea. And that's something that is built into iOS, for example, now. And yeah, looking into the future, I think what is going to be super interesting is AR, VR, and how to make those things accessible. It's a massive challenge. The good thing is in the gaming industry, which is quite related, they do super cool stuff on accessibility. And the other interesting thing as well that I see is that most of the cool features about augmented reality in this case are accessibility based. So with your phone, with your iPhone, for example, there's a feature that lets you recognize doors, and it's going to be able to explain if there's any signs in the door, for example, if there's a number, or it even lets you know if you have to push it or pull it. It does things like recognizing cues or lines of people and letting you know how far the person in front of you is. So I think really mixed reality has so much potential to make the world more accessible that is going to be super interesting to know where it goes.
Yep, that's really cool. And I have to thank you for not immediately saying ChatGPT. You mentioned your book early on. I can give you a second to plug your book. Did you ever publish it, and what is it? Where do we find it?
Awesome. Yeah, it's called Developing Accessible iOS Apps. So super straightforward. If you are an iOS engineer, it can really help you understand like lots of these things we've been talking about in the episode. There's some chapters that are just general accessibility that are useful for the whole team, really.
And with that, yeah, thanks so much. It's been a lot of fun talking to you.
Thanks for that, yeah. It's always a pleasure to spread the love for accessibility.
Outside of all the stuff you do at work, what else are you nerding out about?
Oh, I love coffee. Technically, I'm a certified barista. Making coffee is such an interesting thing for me. I even took a course where you even did an exam at the end of it, but it was super fun to do, and it's, yeah, making coffee is such an interesting thing for me.
Thanks for listening. Make sure to rate us and hit that follow button so you don't miss the next episode. And you can always send us questions at nerdout@spotify.com. Nerd Out at Spotify is produced by Spotify's Ted Vergakis and by Seaplane Armada, who wrote our impossible-to-miss theme song. I'm Dave Zolotowski. Thanks for nerding out with us.